Welcome to the Good Growing Podcast. I am Chris Enroth, horticulture educator with University of Illinois Extension, coming at you from Macomb, Illinois. And we have got a great show for you today. We are going to be talking about cicadas. This is kind of our cicada pre-show. They haven't shown up yet, but we're going to be discussing a little bit about them to be prepared for when they do arrive. And you know, I'm not doing this by myself. I'm joined, as always, every single week by horticulture educator Ken Johnson in Jacksonville. Hey, Ken.
Hello, Chris. Another week talking insects.
I know. Seems like the schedule, the shared schedule that we have, just seems to pop insects more and more these days. You might not have a hand in that, right?
No, not at all.
Of course not. Of course not. Yes. But we do kind of have to talk about this topic, considering that hasn't happened for over 200 years, won't happen for over 200 years afterwards. So kind of big news. It's a big deal. I would say my news feeds are absolutely swarmed with the idea of periodical cicadas. But before we get into that, I just want to check in with you, Ken. How's the garden going so far this year? You getting things in the ground? I know you had a little bit of landscape damage to recover from. So how's it going?
We're getting there. Landscape damage from our new water line is more or less done. It's relatively level. Gotten stuff that we dug, put back in the ground. Got to get my onions in the ground still. The artichokes, that's all still waiting for me. But last week with the really cool temperatures, kind of just planning on putting stuff in, but then that kind of scared me a little bit. So I waited. So that's going to be this week sometime, hopefully. How about you?
Well, I would say I feel like I'm a little bit ahead of the game with our good growing grow along. I'm trying to be a bit more prepared. I've expanded my garden beds, at least in full sun, to try to accommodate some of the things we're going to grow. And so I feel good. I have my flat of cool season stuff. It is hardened off. They are ready to be planted. They're actually outside right now, just chilling in the chilly rain that we're getting at the moment. Onions went in the ground over the weekend. Potatoes have been planted for about 2 weeks now. Oh, Ken, I'm off to the races this year, 2024. Maybe this will be my year. I got my warm season stuff sprouting in the basement. Ginger and turmeric are popping. I need warm weather now so I can start getting everything outside and make some room in my basement.
Yeah, the peppers we started are starting to bloom.
Oh.
Needs to warm up so I can get those outside.
Yeah. No, I perennialized peppers before because in their native habitat, they develop like woody stems and they'll flower. And I actually got peppers inside a few winters and they weren't that great. You know, there's not any pollination. So the pepper fruit is pretty puny, but hey, for a fresh pepper in January, not bad.
Yeah. Get your Q-tips out and start.
Yeah, I could do that.
Become the bee.
Yeah. And it's actually raining this spring, which it didn't do last year. So that's a nice change that we're actually giving a cool, rainy spring. And then we'll get all plant disease questions later this summer about what we're experiencing now. But hey, that's fine. That's normal. Business as usual.
Exactly.
To dive into the topic at hand, Ken, not so much business as usual, periodical cicadas. Now, if you've been living under a rock, maybe you haven't heard about them. So we should probably let people, you know, kind of inform folks, what are periodical cicadas? Now, I'll retract that rock statement because I've been giving talks about cicadas and there is a lot of confusion about our annual cicadas versus periodical cicadas. So Ken, as our resident entomologist bug guy, can you describe the difference between periodical cicadas and an annual cicada?
Yes, that's right. So we have our annual, sometimes called dog day cicadas. Those come out every year in the summer. They're the ones we hear like July, August, a lot of times singing from the trees. This year, though, across Illinois, we're going to have periodical cicadas coming out. So those are coming out in the spring in the Chicago area. That's typically late May or June sometime. Central Southern Illinois, probably mid-May. Late May, somewhere. A lot of it's going to be weather dependent, though. This year, for a while, we were looking like we were going to be really early. It's cooled off some, which has slowed everything down a little bit. I wouldn't be surprised if we're earlier than we normally are for these broods. Our annual, the ones that come out every year, they're bigger. They're about 2 inches long. they're going to be green and brown and black. Whereas our periodical cicadas, those are going to be black. They're going to have orange legs, orange wings, and have red eyes. And they're about an inch long, so they're going to be smaller. And they come out in mass, so millions of them. They cross the entire range where they're emerging this year. Could be trillions of cicadas coming out this year, whereas our annuals, we've got hundreds or thousands, but not the mass quantities coming out. So that's kind of the big difference. Time of year, the appearance, and the just the sheer number that would be coming out this year.
And that's a survival strategy, right? They've synced their emergence times to prime number years, which is very difficult to do in nature, it seems like. It's not common. Mm-hmm. And so predators can't necessarily sync their natural cycle up with a periodical cicada, and then they just overwhelm the system with numbers. And the predators can't eat enough and they can reproduce, and that's their strategy, right, Ken? Is that what the point of why they all emerge in mass?
Yeah, so you get the overwhelm the system, that predator satiation would be the technical term. So basically the predators can eat all they want, be completely full, and they just keep coming. There's no way predators are going to be able to eat everything. Basically, those cicadas are guaranteed that a bunch of them are going to survive, be able to lay eggs, and continue on those generations. And there's a variety of different theories as to why this is. They do this at 13 to 17 years. Is it, you know, prime numbers? It's hard to sync life cycles. There's some theories it's because of ice ages. You know, that slowed the growth of plants down and the insects down, and maybe they started syncing their life cycles to make sure they were emerging at the same time so they can mate. Combination of both, nobody really knows, but those are some theories as to why that happens. And then that predator satiation overwhelming the system. These cicadas don't bite, they don't sting, they're not poisonous, they're not venomous. They basically have no defenses. Their only defense is to be so many of them that they can't possibly eat everybody.
Yeah. And well, the defense has been working for them for generations. So the fascinating idea that these periodical cicadas are spending most of their life underground, 13 and 17 years underground. They emerge and they live as an adult, maybe a month. And that's about it. So Ken, speaking of emergence, the media spheres are abuzz, or singing, I should say, with cicada news, that people are finding like the random cicada in like Chicago, St. Louis. So you had mentioned that we're a little bit accelerated this year in terms of our warm weather patterns. Are we going to, because we were talking about like maybe we'll see peak around end of May, beginning of June for a portion of Illinois. Is that going to get pushed a little bit earlier, or these kind of just early bird gets the worm, early cicada gets the
early cicada the gets eaten. Early
yeah, there you go.
It gets eaten. Yeah. So you don't. I probably don't want to be the first cicada because you're going to get eaten. It's the ones that come after you that'll. This so for cicadas, it pays to procrastinate, I guess. But yeah, so the brood 19, the Great Southern Brood, that's going to be kind of central Illinois, southern Illinois, and that goes into Missouri, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, along the Gulf Coast, up into the Carolinas and stuff. So there's reports of them coming out in the Carolinas. I would assume they're coming out in like Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi as well. I was looking on iNaturalist. There is a picture that somebody posted from the St. Louis area in Missouri of an adult last week. And I've heard, you know, people mention on Facebook that they've seen them in Chicago, but I haven't seen any pictures of the adults. But right now, the nymphs, and, you know, in my backyard, we can pop a picture up of this. The nymphs are starting to dig their holes, their emergence holes. So they'll dig those holes a couple weeks before they actually emerge. They'll dig them, and they just kind of sit in the ground until soil temperatures about 8 inches deep at 64 degrees Fahrenheit. And a lot of times that's associated with rain as well. So, you know, if it gets 64 and it's really dry, they may wait there for a while. But once we get rain, then a lot of times they'll start emerging. And we were getting pretty close in Springfield early last week. Soil temperatures were 62, 63, 64 degrees, somewhere in there. But then we had that big cold snap. And now, you know, Tuesday, last I recording this Tuesday, last I looked, it was soil temperature is around 55, 56 degrees. So that's kind of slowed everything down. I think Southern Illinois, they were past that 64 degree threshold, but I have not heard of anything coming out down there. So now that it's cooled off, I think we're, and looking at the 10-day forecast, we're going to get some warm days, but I don't know if we're going to get enough to really, to get them emerging. So it's, it depends. It's all going to be based on the weather and what's happening with that.
And so I guess when it comes to emergence, and you, the big deal about this is a lot of people say, oh, these two broods are emerging at the same time in the same place. But you just described Great Southern Brood is in kind of that southern part of Illinois, and then the states that you mentioned, and then the Northern Illinois Brood, that is kind of, and so they actually aren't overlapping to much extent, but there might be instances where you might see species from both broods overlapping, correct?
Yeah, there is that potential. See, I think a lot of people, you know, we've been talking a lot about this double brood emergence. You know, first time since 1803, isn't going to happen again until 2245. So every 221 years, this happens. So I think a lot of people kind of have this expectation that we're going to have two broods emerging at the same time in the same places. So we're going to have twice as many periodical cicadas as we normally would. That's not, that, like you mentioned, that's not really going to be the case. There's kind of a pretty clear line between where these kind of two broods emerge. Springfield area may have both broods emerging, but they're, these two broods are not expected to overlap to any great extent. So it's going to be kind of a typical emergence kind of locally. It's more the looking big picture, you know, this doesn't happen. This happens every 221 years.
Mm. Yeah. The sheer geography of that scope is, that's a lot of cicadas happening across North America, where, as far as we know, North America is one of the few places where we have periodical cicadas, maybe the only place where we have periodical cicadas, other than, I think, was it Australia might have something?
Yeah, someone like in India, called like the World Cup cicada, because it comes out every 4 years when they're the World Cup or something like that.
That's cool.
I don't know, but I think that's a different, I don't think it's the same genus as we have here. So the periodical cicadas in North America are magic cicada, because they're magical cicadas.
Yes, they are.
So I think it's a different group, and I don't know if those, if those are considered periodic or not, because even our annual, our dog day cicadas, they're in the ground for several years. They don't, their life cycle is longer than 1 year. They just haven't synced up their emergence. So, you know, some of our, or ones that are coming out every year, that annual dog day cicadas, they may have 2, 3, 4 year life cycles, but they're not synced up. You've got individuals emerging every year, whereas the periodical, everything is synced up, emerging at once.
Well, and I guess the other thing to also be mindful of is that I really like this statistic that in this ideal habitat situation where there have been trees, it's been forested, that you can get 1.5 million cicadas per acre, which makes it sound like, oh my gosh, we're going to be inundated with these insects. But it is the, it is really variable in terms of the density. I recall the last time the, Northern Illinois brood emerged, and you would just, it was, you would find cicadas there, very common, but it was in pockets. It was kind of like how Japanese beetles are today. You know, just not just widespread Japanese beetles across the state of Illinois. They just occur in these like isolated little pockets. And the periodical cicadas back when I recall the Northern Illinois brood emerging, it was like in pockets. These pockets are really loud. You could hear them clearly with your windows rolled up going like 65 miles per hour down the interstate. But again, it was, the density was variable. So it's not necessarily going to be just a swarm of cicadas coming at you.
Yeah, they're not going to blanket the earth. So you got to have that right habitat. So cicadas, they're living in the ground, they're feeding on tree roots. So one, if you're gonna have cicadas in the area, they had to have been there 13 years ago or 17 years ago, depending on
the trees. Yeah,
this trees and the cicadas. Yeah, if you have no trees in that area 13 or 17 years ago, depending on where you're at, you're not going to have any cicadas because they've had nothing. They didn't lay their eggs in there. They have nothing to feed on. So if you're in a newer subdivision that used to be a farm field, you're not going to have any cicadas. If you live in town, an older part of town where you've got large mature trees, you had cicadas 13 or 17 years ago, more than likely you're going to have them again this year. See, I think, you know, out in the country, so to speak, especially here in central Illinois, we've got a lot of farm fields. Probably not going to have as many cicadas around there unless you've got, you know, the little forest pockets around water and stuff like that may have some. But I think a lot of areas you're going to see more of them in town, especially older parts of town that have those older trees and stuff that they're able to support those populations. So now in southern Illinois, where everything's forested, where you have more forested areas, or maybe some parts of northern Illinois, we've got the forest reserves and stuff. You'll probably see more in some of those areas.
So with potentially across the Midwest and the eastern portions of the country, with trillions of cicadas, trillions and trillions of cicadas emerging, are they got to eat something, right? Are they going to eat all our plants? Is this going to be like a swarm of locusts flying across the landscape? What do we need to be afraid of? What's the scary part of this, Ken? Is it all just rainbows and sunshine?
Dip and gloom. See, speaking of locusts, sometimes people call them locusts, but they are not. Locusts are a type of grasshopper. Right. So these are not locusts. So this is not a biblical plague coming for us. So as far as, you know, what they're going after. So there is a one belief I've heard quite a bit is that the adult cicadas do not feed. That's not actually the case. They will feed, but they don't really feed a whole lot. So that's not really what we're concerned about. But some studies I've looked at, they've actually captured cicadas and done DNA analysis on them to see what they're feeding on. And it's usually hardwood trees. I think they found some stuff on some herbaceous stuff. Let me look at the list. White clover, some of them had in their guts. Marijuana, prickly lettuce. So there's some herbaceous type stuff, but they're not feeding enough to cause any damage or really be any concern. That's not what we're worried about. What we're worried about is the egg laying. So when the females are growing up, so the males will, they emerge, males will go up into the treetops and they'll start singing. That's going to attract females. They'll mate. Females will then start laying eggs in woody plant material. You've got a large, mature, well-established tree, healthy tree, you've got nothing to worry about. When they're laying their eggs, they'll make a slit into those branches and put their eggs in there. We may see some flagging where those branches kind of break and the tips of the branches will turn brown and kind of dangle. Those trees are going to be fine. This has been happening for thousands and thousands of years, and trees have survived. Those plants, those trees put out more leaves than they need, so they can afford to lose some and they'll be all right. The concern is more your small trees, newly planted trees and shrubs that don't have very big diameter. Usually about the size of a pencil is what they're looking to lay their eggs in, maybe up to an inch or so in diameter. So if you have that type of stuff, you probably want to protect those, cover it in some sort of netting. Ideally, you don't want the holes to be any bigger than a quarter, maybe half an inch in size. And that will keep the cicadas off the trees, prevent them from laying eggs. On our newly planted stuff, you know, they don't have a whole lot of branches. You start losing some branches here and there, that could have a significant impact. May not kill the tree, but it's going to set it back, and you may have to do some pruning to get the proper structure again. If it's a really small tree and they can lay their eggs into the trunk of the tree, if that happens and it snaps, you know, either your tree is dead or you're going to have a really bushy thing and you have to do a whole lot of work to get that to kind of be the right form. And I was doing some reading on it, you know, they're kind of generalists. They'll lay their eggs and all kinds of stuff, but it does seem to have some preferences. So Morton Arboretum, last name that came out up there, so that was 17 years ago. Some of the plants that they had that were most affected were maples, cherries, ashes, hawthorns, willows, oaks, pears, rose, privet, poplar, serviceberry, and beeches. So that's a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But if it's your trees are well established, you know, decent size, nothing to worry about. Just enjoy it. Don't use pesticides. They don't do a particularly good job of protecting the trees from them. Their studies have been done that show that netting works better than pesticides do. Pesticides are going to be of limited use and not recommended in residential settings. Now, if you're a commercial fruit grower or something like that, then yes, you're going to need to probably spray your trees to prevent damage to those so you can get a crop this year.
Speaking of netting, I'll share my screen so Ken can see what I'm talking about, and then I will pop these images in here after the fact here later on through the magic of editing. when it comes to some of this netting, it can be pretty simple. It can be as simple as just taking insect netting and just draping it over the plant. We do have some images. Morton Arboretum sent out a couple images of what to do and how to prepare for this. So we'll pop those up here with Ken and I. So Ken, when you look at this image right here, we see a small tree. Pretty much all of these stems are about the diameter or width of the pencil. So, the major hazard here is not necessarily those branches coming off here. In this case, it's going to be the main trunk. So if they start laying their eggs in that main trunk, they could totally the easiest thing that they're the least detrimental thing is they could top that tree and it'll have to resprout. Worst case scenario, though, is they kill the tree outright by girdling the trunk totally. And the tree doesn't send up new growth.
Yeah, that or you got like a wind gust snaps it because you've got some damage there. And you can see in this picture, they've secured that netting to the base of the tree. That's going to be important. You don't just want to drape it over, especially if you're in an area where they may be emerging from the ground in that area. Secure that so they can't crawl up that netting and get into there.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to share a couple of videos here with Ken. So because my 10-year-old helped me out here, I'm going to try to edit these so that they're not so jittery and shaky. But Ken, so what I did, so I planted two trees last year, two smaller trees, an oak and a black gum tree. And I selected these trees for why I tell people to select these trees, because they have a good central leader. Now, I'm kind of afraid that if I put that netting over my trees, I might damage that central leader in some way, because, you know, in Illinois, we get wind and there's going to be a lot of, wind and movement of that material. So I wanted to protect my central leader. So what I did, Ken, I'm just going to fast forward through this. I had a very long wooden stake. I would say it's probably like 4 foot tall. And to the stake, I just took like scrap pieces of wood that I had, and I just brad nailed pieces of, in this case, what we're looking at, some garden stakes, wooden garden stakes here. And so in the end, what I'm trying to do, you can tell, Ken, is I'm basically making like it, like three, or sorry, what, see these two wooden stakes crossing each other on this post. So essentially, picture in your head, you're at a crossroads and there's a sign and there's an arrow pointing down all four roads. That's what I'm creating. And the idea here is this top portion that's going to buffer the netting from impacting my central leader. And then these cross braces are going to keep the netting kind of away a little bit from some of those side branches. So to protect it from any damage from wind. So again, we just brad nailed these together. Yeah, Ken's like, what in the world? Yeah, so this is the fun of my child trying to do a video work for me. He did a great job, though. Thanks. Thank you, Eli. So again, here's this one. And so if you're one of those people that likes to hoard scraps of lumber, hey, this is your time to shine. They finally have a use. So again, we're brad nailing just these extra scraps of lumber. And I'm just using brad nails because these only have to last a few weeks. These are not permanent fixtures in the landscape. So you can see right here, I'm creating that post, those cross beams there to protect both the central leader up top, some of those side branches. And then when it comes to installing them, let's see. So here's my black gum tree. So first I have to take the deer fencing off, and I get to shout at the deer, ha ha, you didn't get my trees this winter. So we take off the fencing, and then we install the cross brace right there. And there's also T-posts in the shot that I use to keep the deer fencing up. I mean, if you really wanted to, I could just take one of those T-posts there, put it in the ground next to that trunk, and put that insect netting over top of that. That will protect the central leader just as well. But I wanted to add those cross braces maybe to give a little bit more room inside of that netting for some of my side branches.
I said, like you mentioned, you know, this isn't a permanent thing. This is cicadas will be out 4 to 6 weeks and then we'll be back to business as usual.
So again, I have that covered. So I have row cover fabric. I don't have any insect netting. In a perfect world, I would have insect netting. I realize this row cover fabric is a little bit dense, so there's not as much light getting through there as I would like. But essentially what I did is I took the base and I wadded it up and I pinned it to the ground, but it wasn't quite long, wide enough to go over the entire tree and make it to the bottom. So I pinned the excess side to the ground, and then I just took some clips right here, and I just clipped those together, rolled it up, clipped it together so the cicadas couldn't make their way into any holes that might be in there. So again, this is all temporary. I am super excited to get these out of the landscape as soon as possible, so I don't have these little ghosts. I mean, if it was Halloween, this would work perfectly, but it's springtime.
Save them for Halloween.
Yeah, I might do that. Oh, anyway, that's what I did this morning when it was raining.
Yeah, I still need to get all my netting, get all that pulled together and put up. So another weekend project.
I know. Good. Yeah. The weekends are getting less and less, Ken, before emergence time.
It's a good thing it cooled off.
Yes. Well, so Ken, we tend to focus on the negative aspects of cicadas. There's got to be some good, right? I mean, we talked about predator satiation, so wildlife value must be good. What's the good side of this thing? I mean, we focused on tree damage, but what makes you happy to have these cicadas showing up?
Well, one, it's just awesome. Everybody should be happy because it's awesome. And it's a once in a multi-generational opportunity to have two broods emerging. Realize I'm probably not liar thinking of that, but there are some, I guess, some, should we say, ecological benefits to this. So, you know, right now they're digging their emergence holes. That's going to help aerate the soil. So if you go out in your garden or an area where you have trees, look at the ground, you may see holes about the size of a dime in the ground. Some of them may have little turrets, caps on them. That's to help prevent water from getting in there. And inside we'll have our little cicadas. So I dug these up for my backyard. They've got the red eyes, which is one indication that they're getting ready to emerge. I've had them inside trying to see if I can force them to molt early. It hasn't happened yet, but maybe I'll get there. I was hoping I could have a live adult to show, but maybe next time. So they're, you know, they're aerating the soil. They've been in the ground, you know, sometimes 8+ inches deep. So they're moving up, helping to aerate the soil. That'll make water infiltration and all that fun stuff easier. When they're laying their eggs, we get some natural pruning of trees, and this can lead to a flush of growth. Maybe this year, maybe next year. They found in some trees they get increased flowering that following year because of this natural pruning. So more flowers, could be more seed, more fruit production, which could be a double-edged sword. If you got more seed production in maples, you may not be too happy about it, but in other things that could be a good thing. You know, we haven't really talked about, eventually these cicadas are going to die. And when they do, it's going to smell terrible. I've heard of talking to my neighbors last time they came out, they were piled up maybe an inch or two deep around trees. So it's going to smell terrible, like roadkill for a while. But I guess the silver lining to that is it's free fertilizer. You know, these cicadas have been in the ground for 13 or 17 years. They've been slowly accumulating these nutrients from trees and stuff. When they die, bodies will break down. And again, you have a big spike of nutrients available to plants. So another way they can get to see that increased growth potentially because of this. And a lot of things are going to eat them. You have some animals may almost exclusively switch over to feeding on cicadas. A lot of birds will feed on them. Small mammals will. I think they've been looking at stuff. You know, when birds start switching over to cicadas, caterpillar populations see a boost because nothing's eating them for several weeks. So you have more survival in those, which again could be a double-edged sword. You may have more of those caterpillars feeding on plants, but you know, depending on the species, you're going to see more of those. And if they're, I guess, what we would consider a desirable species, you may see more butterflies. Because we have this abundant food source, you may be seeing more like hatchlings survive because there's, you know, there's just all kinds of food. Food scarcity isn't going to be an issue, at least while the cicadas are out. and things like that. And then, you know, you yourself can always eat them as well. And I guess that can be our sneak peek to our cicada eating podcast in a few weeks here. So we'll do a whole podcast on eating cicadas, how to collect them and prepare them and all of that. But humans can eat them too, if they so desire.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess, Ken, are there any cicada harvesting, foraging areas to avoid if you were a said human that is going to partake in this willingly? I will be willingly partaking in this, and I'm looking forward to it. But where should we not eat cicadas from?
Yeah, so first off, you're allergic to shellfish, don't eat cicadas. They're related. Shrimp and lobsters are just aquatic insects, kind of. So don't eat them if you're allergic to that. You don't want to collect them from areas where you have a lot of pesticide use. Again, they've been in the soil for a long time. They could be accumulating that stuff. So heavy pesticide use, concerns with soil contamination with heavy metals. Again, same idea. They've been in the ground for a long time, potentially accumulating those heavy metals. So avoid those areas as well.
Well, Ken, I'm ready. I'm ready for them to show up. I'm ready for them to be here. As you saw, I got my frames built for my tree. I've got the row cover installed. I am prepared. Yet when I look at the map of where the two broods will emerge, where I'm in McDonough County, is this little island in the cicada madness that is about to occur. So I, fingers crossed, that it's just because no one reported the Great Northern Brood was here when it happened last time. But hopefully I'll also get some cicadas like everybody else in Illinois. But for some reason, I'm on this little island in the part of the state. I hope I get some.
Yeah, well, a lot of the maps, there's a lot of variation. I think a lot of it depends on how they're doing their data collection. Mm-hmm. You know, are they relying on actual specimens that have been collected? Or are they just relying on people reporting sightings? I think there's probably some gaps in the map that there probably shouldn't be. I guess we'll find out soon enough, though.
Yeah. Ready or not, here they come. Yeah. So, well, that was a lot of great information about cicadas, getting ready for them, being prepared, being well informed about what to expect. Well, the Good Growing Podcast is a production of University of Illinois Extension, edited this week by me, Chris Enroth. And a special thank you, Ken. Thank you for sitting down. I mean, boy, I really had to strong arm you into that chair to get you to talk about insects again this week. But thank you for laying down the knowledge of periodical cicadas.
Yes, thank you. And everybody, enjoy it. It's going to be awesome. It'll be another 13 or 17 years before you see them. So enjoy it while it lasts.
Enjoy it and eat up.
Exactly. And let's do this again next week.
Oh, we shall do this again next week. Do you think you can grow fruit in containers, like on your patio? Well, we're going to talk about how you might be able to do that with horticulture educator Bruce Black about containerized fruit planting. So that'll be fun. I'm looking forward to that. So listeners, thank you for doing what you do best, and that is listening. Or if you're watching us on YouTube, watching. And as always, keep on growing.